Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respects to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. Today is the 17th of March, 2026, and my name is Fung, and in the studio with me, we've got Juliet and Elena. Good morning.
Good morning.
I do have to apologise for my voice. I am still recovering. But it is me, Fung.
Well, welcome back, Fung. We've definitely missed you the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, what's been going on this past few days?
Oh, that's a good question. The first thing that's coming to my mind is that there's a new cram guide that's in preparation at the moment. So I've been doing a bit of research and I found a really fun graphic for Women on the Line.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's got these women hanging on a washing line.
Women
it's
on
very
the line.
Sweet, yeah.
Literally, yeah, yeah. And I'm sure making a great point maybe about how women tend to do more of the domestic work at home. Or I don't know when this graphic was made, but I'm sure
yeah,
that was maybe a key point.
It was either the 80s or the 90s.
Yeah,
but yeah, I was also trying to find out when did breakfast start, but I didn't quite get to the bottom of that. But
yeah.
I don't think it wasn't around in 1985, I don't think, at least in this kind of format.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, well, an ongoing investigation. Or you'll have to wait until you receive your cram guide if you're a subscriber.
That's
to find out what
yes.
Juliet is writing about.
That is not the topic of my
I love when you like are actually supposed to be researching something and then you go on a slight tangent and then it's like a rabbit hole into something completely different.
Yeah.
And then like an hour later you're like, what am I doing? Whoops.
Yeah. No. And it's been interesting seeing photos of people like when they were younger. Like I saw a photo of Juliet Fox and then I was thinking, oh, I'm doing all this, you know, sifting through this history, and she's obviously done a lot of it. So yeah, it's a tradition being passed down through the Juliets.
through the Juliets specifically.
Yeah.
And Elena, how are you going?
I'm good. I've been busy lately. Been back at it with uni and with work and being here. So it's good. It's busy, but it's good.
Yeah, very busy. Well, we've got a very big show coming up for everyone today. So we'll just quickly go through the rundown. First up, we'll be speaking to Violet Coco, who is a member of the Bob Brown Foundation, but many of you may have already heard of her because she's been heavily involved in direct action since 2018. She is most known for facing prison in two separate states for blocking both the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Westgate Bridge to call for climate action. And she'll be on the show to talk to us about the upcoming March in March for Native Forests, which is taking place across in multiple cities across so-called Australia this coming Sunday, the 22nd of March, 2026. At 7:30, we'll be joined by India, who is a local from the city of Port Phillip, involved in grassroots activism around housing, homelessness and climate change. She's also a part of Care Not Cruelty, which is a grassroots coalition of locals that are fighting for a human rights-led housing-first response to homelessness. And she'll be on the show to talk about the proposed amendment to local laws in the city of Port Phillip, which would grant officers the power to remove any so-called encampment equipment from those sleeping rough.
And then at 7:45, we're going to listen to an interview with visual artists Fiona Barbaretti and Stephanie Sue, who are both exhibiting currently at Trocadero Projects in Footscray. So we're going to talk about their exhibition, which is entitled RAGE, which stands for Random Acts of Gentle Expression, with fellow artists Aldona Kmek, Lawrence Wong and Catalina Labra Ode. And we'll talk about the themes of the exhibition and how they explore the question of sustaining a creative practice.
At 8 o'clock, Julia will be speaking to Nazanin, who is an Iranian immigrant and feminist advocating for women's rights in Iran. And they'll be speaking about the current upheaval across the country, as well as the difficulties in getting access to news out of Iran due to the internet blackout and the current attacks on Iran there.
And then finally at 8:15, we're going to listen to an excerpt of a February episode of Breadline in which Danielle interviewed Dr. Rachel Iampolsky, an urban geographer and member of the Save Public Housing Collective. And they speak about the strategy to protect high-rise public housing towers through pursuing a heritage listing and what that application involves and how it applies in the case of the flats.
So that's what's coming up on today's show, and as always, we'll be here with the news headlines right after this. Some folks know about it, some don't. Some know. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. Some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Now one, two, nitty-gritty, now yeah.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, 17th of March, 2026. A remote Aboriginal community north of Broome has released a new strategy aimed at strengthening health and well-being through cultural governance and community control. The Jurinjin Aboriginal Corporation last week launched its updated Binimal Amburini Strong People Healthy Living strategy, setting out how organisations and service providers are expected to work with the community. Jurinjin sits about 170 kilometres north of Broome on the Dampier Peninsula in Western Australia's Kimberley region. The strategy builds on the corporation's long-term vision and comes as the organisation has grown into what it describes as a largely self-funded, community-controlled body with more than 90% of its operations funded independently. Under the framework, organisations working in Jurinjin are expected to follow the community's cultural governance processes and priorities. Chief Executive Nathan McIver said the strategy reflected the community's determination to guide its own future. He added, "It ensures that anyone who comes to work with us walks in the same direction, guided by our cultural governance, strengthening our people, our culture, and our future." Listeners are advised that the next headline mentions an Aboriginal person who has died. Also in the news, a 35-year-old Aboriginal woman has died in Western Australia's Bundyup Women's Prison. The woman was found unresponsive in her single occupancy cell early Monday morning. The WA Department of Justice said prison staff provided first aid to the woman before St John WA paramedics arrived. She was declared deceased at the site. The department said preliminary reports indicate there were no suspicious circumstances. As it is mandatory for all deaths in custody, WA police will prepare a report for the state coroner. Megan Krakoa, director of the National Suicide Prevention and Trauma Recovery Project, said the death of the 35-year-old woman was a tragedy and my thoughts are with her family, loved ones and community. She also calls for the continued work of confronting the systemic abuses that see Aboriginal people so heavily overrepresented in our justice system. There have been more than 600 Indigenous deaths in custody in Australia since the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody brought down its findings and issued over 300 recommendations for reform in 1991. If you need support after hearing this, please call 13 Yarn 139276 or Lifeline on 13 11 14.
In other news, the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, IPAN, calls on the Australian government to condemn the illegal and brutal US-Israeli war being prosecuted against Iran and Lebanon and immediately withdraw all Australian Defence Force assets from Iran and the surrounding areas. IPAN supports the recent announcement by Transport Minister Catherine King that Australia will not send a ship to the Strait of Hormuz after US President Trump calls on all countries who receive fuel through the Strait of Hormuz to send naval support. The U.S. and Israel are the cause of the current crisis and devastation currently happening, and no support should be provided to them, said retired Army Major Cameron Leckie. IPAN is calling for immediate cessation of hostilities and for all parties to pursue diplomatic negotiations. The unreliability of the United States towards its allies has been recently demonstrated by its diversion of missiles from the U.S., which Australia has paid for, being arbitrarily diverted to the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Finally, in the headlines, voters in Vietnam have cast their ballots for the members of the National Assembly, the country's top legislative body, which serves mainly to ratify decisions by the governing Communist Party. Nearly 93% of the 864 parliamentary candidates in Sunday's election are Communist Party members, while 7.5% are independents, according to the National Election Council, down from the 8.5% in 2021. The 5-yearly elections in the tightly controlled one-party state will see more than 73 million voters elect 500 members of the National Assembly and representatives for the local councils. The Communist Party, which has ruled the Southeast Asian nation for more than 100 million people unopposed for decades, holds 97% of the parliamentary seats. Voters expressed hope their representatives would continue modernizing Vietnam, whose booming economy is undergoing major reforms introduced by top leader Thu Lam. Results are expected on March 23rd. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, the 17th of March. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Come to the Degrowth Festival on Sunday the 22nd of March from 11 a.m. till 7 p.m. Building community and resilience. Let's create the world we want by practicing it now together. Sing, dance, picnic under the trees, and check out the dozens of stalls, workshops, and talks. The 2026 Degrowth Festival, Curtin Square, Carlton. Search for Degrowth Festival 2026 on Humanitix for more details and to register. The Degrowth Festival is a 3CR supporter.
Hi, my name is Miss Kininama Pradiodiora, Jajarong, Kalkadun and Yirrindali, Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
Welcome back to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au. We're joined this morning by Violet, who is a member of the Bob Brown Foundation and has been heavily involved in direct action for climate and environment since 2018. She's most known for facing prison in two separate states for blocking both the Sydney Harbour Bridge and Westgate Bridge to call for climate and ecological emergency declaration. Violet joins us on the program this morning to chat about the upcoming March for Native Forests taking place in multiple cities across so-called Australia on Sunday the 22nd of March 2026. She will also be speaking about the threats of planned burns and destruction caused by fire breaks contracted by Forest Fire Management Victoria. Welcome to 3CR, Violet.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us so early in the morning. I was wondering if you could first start by outlining some of the key issues concerning the forest community at the moment and some of the issues that you'll be marching for or, speaking about at the march this Sunday.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to speak for the forests. They so rarely get a stage and it's so important. Our forests provide us with oxygen and food and medicine and obviously our whole ecosystems for creatures, and yet Victoria Forest Fire Management are actually destroying more forest now than they have previously before they supposedly ended native forest logging. And they're doing that through these so-called strategic fire breaks or other fuel breaks, which is where they bypass all the environmental protections and decimate these forests and clear the land. And the thing about these strategic fire breaks is the best science that we have says that they actually make our forests more flammable. And so it's basically an election promise or making themselves look good by saying they're doing something about the climate emergency and all these fires that we're experiencing, but what they're doing is actually making it more dangerous for our community and destroying more forest than ever, which is obviously going to accelerate the climate crisis.
And that's something that we've talked about on the show before with, you know, activists from Victorian Forest Alliance, but also King Lake Friends of the Forest, is how destructive these planned burns are. And yet we know that, you know, bushfires in Australia, but and especially in Victoria, is quite a sensitive topic. And just talking about the not only like the lack of accountability from FFMV, but also the misinformation around planned burns that's out there in the community, and not really explaining to the community what you just said is that these fire breaks actually make forests more exposed to the threat of fires. I was wondering if you could talk about, I guess, the transition or change from Vic Forest to Forest Fire Management Victoria. We know that there's been an end to, a so-called end to native logging with the disbanding of Vic Forest. But how do you see the continuation of this, I guess, state-sanctioned destruction through contracts by FFMV?
Yeah, well, they had 21 logger contracts under Vic Forest, and 19 of them have been renewed under Forest Fire Management. And those 19 must be working harder than ever because, as I said, they are destroying more forest than they were under the logging scheme.
Yeah, and that's something I think that's really important for people to keep an eye on, because, you know, in the last 12 months we have seen the end of VicForest, which is a win in and of itself because a lot of community groups and individuals worked really hard for that. But yeah, just to know that it hasn't really ended. I know that there's a new citizen science database that's being launched for people to report planned burns that are happening in the area. I was wondering if you could talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, basically these planned burns, we're seeing a lot of destruction from them. We know that there are planned burns that have escaped. There's burns that have damaged or burnt private property. There's lots of health impacts from the smoke. There's excessive clearing, there's hollow-bearing trees that have been burnt out or felled, and lots of evidence of dead wildlife. And so what the VFA, Victoria Forest Alliance, have done, have asked for people to start submitting any evidence that they know of these things, using the community to gather a database.
Yeah, and that sounds like it would be such an important resource for those community groups. And we know that citizen science is so important when it comes to recording what's happening in our forests, because we know that a lot of the time when there are teams that are sent from the government or other big corporations, they're not actually looking at what's happening very carefully, or perhaps omitting certain things. So that will be a really, an incredible resource that people can contribute to. Just going back to the March for Native Forests, which is happening this Sunday, last year's march was a great success. I know, you know, the one in Naarm was held outside Peter Khalil's office, and that was before a federal election, and we had photos showing all these communities coming out across different cities. So I was wondering if you could talk about this coming Sunday. Why is it important for people to come out? And, you know, as we head into a state election, why should forests be a key issue for people?
Yeah, well, we are still in a climate and ecological emergency, and our global heating is reaching really alarming rates, and forests are known not only to sequester carbon, but also they cool the planet, and they also move water, and water is a really important part of what's happening with the climate. So forests are really essential for healing the damage that capitalism and colonialism has done on this continent. And so it's really, really important to turn up for the forest this Sunday. It's at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens, and we're actually going to be marching up to the intersection in front of DECA, and, you know, making our stand there, which is DECA is the Department of Energy, Environment and Climate in Action, which is where the Forest Fire Management Victoria make all these decisions about what's happening with our forest. So we're going to expose them. We're going to have some scientists speak. We've got Yaram Bundle, this amazing First Nations woman who is the fire keeper at Camp Sovereignty, and also recently did a two-day tree sit down in Lutruwita, where the song line of the Swift Parrot connects from that country to her country in Jabiroong. So it'll be very important to turn up and listen to what she has to say about what's happening on her country as well. Speak for the trees, because they don't get a voice unless we give them a voice. And in this election coming up, we need to make sure that politicians know that forests matter to us, and that we're going to be voting for forests first.
Thank you so much for that, Violet. It sounds like it's going to be an incredible event, and I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with Yaram Bundle and how incredible her activism is, and in speaking up for, like you said, her country and her sacred song lines. And so, yeah, just to confirm, that's happening this Sunday at 11 a.m. Just wanted to thank you so much, Violet, for coming on the show this morning and talking to us. Just quickly, if people want to stay up to date with any news coming out about the forest, do you have any resources that they can look to?
Yeah, locally, Victoria Forest Alliance is an amazing organisation to be connected to. They'll be at the rally with a stall, so you can sign up with them there. You can check out their socials, or they have a really comprehensive website.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for joining us on the show this morning.
Thank you so much for having us. Bye.
We've been speaking to Violet Coco from the Bob Brown Foundation. As discussed in the interview, there will be nationwide protests happening on Sunday, the 22nd of March, organised by the Bob Brown Foundation, but will be attended by lots of local groups. And in Nam, this will be held at Parliament Gardens on Albert Street at 11 a.m. We'll be back with a song right after these messages.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Nam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
I'll be sleeping under stars tonight. Not sure exactly where I'll be. Maybe underneath the pale moonlight, or maybe underneath that tree. Black smoke riding in the sky tonight. Everything will be alright if you let go. Gathered in a place tonight. Everything will be alright if you let go.
Yeah.
tonight. Everything will be alright if you let go. Humans will gather in the place tonight. Everything will be alright if you let
go. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and that was the song Black Smoke by Emily Waramara. Next up, we'll be speaking to India, who is a member of Care Not Cruelty, about the amendment to local laws proposed by the City of Port Phillip that will give officers the power to remove any so-called encampment equipment accused of impacting amenity or safety. Here to discuss the harm that this law would cause people experiencing homelessness is India, a local from the City of Port Phillip, involved in grassroots activism around housing, homelessness and climate change. She has a background in social work and is passionate about creating systemic change. She's also a part of Care Not Cruelty, a grassroots coalition of locals that believe responses to homelessness should be led by housing first, human rights approaches rather than punitive or enforcement-based approaches. And they are currently organising to oppose the City of Port Phillip local law change. Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, India.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, India, last time we spoke was around June last year, 2025, when the City of Port Phillip was looking to establish no camping zones in the area that would target rough sleepers. I was wondering if you could give us a brief outline of what has happened since then and where we're at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. As you said, this process has been going on for a while now. Last year in June, council held community consultation around making no encampment zones. This was also after they initiated a process to create a community safety roundtable, and the report came out from that, as well as through the community consultation, that a majority of the residents of City of Phillip were opposed to local law change as a response to street encampments and homelessness in a housing crisis. The Community Safety Roundtable report had really great recommendations in it, including creating a gathering hub and, basically told council that they didn't think that law change was an appropriate or necessary response to street encampments and rough sleepers. But unfortunately, in December, council decided to bring in a modified version of the proposal that they did consultation on. This time, instead of making no encampment zones, they have changed the wording of the law change to focus on encampment equipment. This means that it's actually a broader change, because it's not going to just target people that are in a group of three or more. It can target anyone that has something called encampment equipment, which could include things such as cardboard to sleep on, sleeping bags, warm clothes, pillows, anything that people use to survive. So currently, council are now doing another community consultation on this new proposal to see if they can change the law despite the opposition.
Thank you so much for that summary, India. Like you said just now, it seems incredibly severe to target people sleeping rough when we're experiencing an acute housing crisis. And the amendment to the local laws that you've just described now, where it's not necessarily, it's not targeting groups, but targeting equipment, which can now have an impact on not just groups, but individuals or anyone really on the street, is quite, it's going to be widespread, the impact. And so I was wondering if you could talk about this a bit more, in terms of your work and your organising around this area, as well as your background in social work. How is this going to impact people? And and wondering if you could talk a bit more about these laws as a way of criminalising homelessness and people experiencing poverty.
As you said, this is happening in like a context, a wider context around the state, around Australia. We've just seen in Moreton Bay in Queensland, Moreton Bay Castle has been found to be breached homeless people's human rights from removing their encampment equipment. So, yeah, this is definitely happening amongst a wider trend of criminalising poverty and really controlling how people show up in public spaces. So this law proposal is, the council has written in that it will be a, quote, last resort. So if people have been asked to move because they're, they've been deemed an amenity or safety issue for any person on council land, and they've been asked to leave, if they don't, they could have their survival items impounded. I think, yeah, the fact that council said it is the last resort is really interesting because, of course, we're living in a time where the system for getting support is very convoluted. It's very difficult. There are often no resources available for these people. So I'm just thinking that this is not actually going to be a last resort, and will really just escalate tensions between council officers, police, and rough sleepers. It means that people are going to have to spend more time working through getting their things back rather than figuring out how they're going to survive the next night. It means that they'll probably be disconnected from their support system. It's effectively using their survival items as sort of some sort of blackmail to try and force people to move on, because council doesn't have the powers to move people on themselves. And it's just a very dehumanizing response to people who are just trying to survive on the streets. And as like Southside Justice and other service providers and groups have argued, there are already ways that the council can respond to aggressive or criminal behaviour that doesn't target the way that people are trying to survive in the most difficult of circumstances.
Yeah, thank you for that. And it seems that when the council writes or words that in a way, for example, you know, last resort, or even just using words such as, you know, yeah, amenity and safety of the community, that seems to be quite vague and at the discretion of local council officers and the police, without there being any sort of broader accountability there as to how they're going to enforce that. And like you said just now, none of this really attacks root issues, which is, you know, the housing crisis, but also the lack of community spaces for people to go and gather within the community, and in fact criminalising that, given that it's happening, you know, outside as opposed to other people who have the means to be able to gather in other spaces. For people who want to get involved, what can they do? I know that there's an online survey form So I was wondering if you could talk people through that and maybe, give them some next steps if they want to take action.
Yeah, sure. So you're right, there is a survey online at the moment that the council have, and anyone that has a connection to the City of Port Phillip can is eligible to participate in the survey. You just need to go to haveyoursay.portphillip.vic.au. /community amenity amendment. It's a really short survey, just sort of asks, like, do you oppose the law or support it, you know, and what your context is, and if you have any more ideas or experience of lived experience of homelessness or housing. If you are a like member and live in the City of Port Phillip, call or email your councillor before the end of the month. We only have until the 29th of March to participate in the community consultation. Just let them know that this isn't something you agree with. It's not recommended by any community service providers. It's only going to fracture relationships with service provider, further push people away from the help that they need. And the other thing that we're doing is we're going to be having a film screening of a documentary called Bay Views for All with the Faye Public Housing Collective. We'll be doing that at the St. Kilda Sports Club at 66 Fitzroy Street on the 25th of March, which is next Wednesday, from 6 p.m. So if people want to come along, learn more about how the housing crisis and the attack on public housing is connected to the increase of homelessness, it would be great to see people there. We're going to have a bunch of speakers, including Kieran, Fluffy, Spike, Arku, and Janine, who are all activists or people with lived experience of housing insecurity or former residents of public housing. So, yeah, it'll be a great night. Come along to that or fill out the survey.
Yeah, thanks so much for that, India. And so many of those speakers are friends of 3CR. So, and I can already see posters for the event around the station, which is great. So, yeah, we'll make sure to include those details in our show notes. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on the show to talk more about these proposed law changes.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
That was India speaking to us about the proposed amendments to local laws that would further punish people experiencing homelessness in the city of Port Phillip. To have your say, you can complete the survey on the City of Port Phillip website, which will be open until 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, the 29th of March. You can find the link via care.not.cruelty on Instagram or on our website after the show. And just to repeat those details from India regarding the film screening next week. It's a documentary called Bay Views for All about the fight to save Barak Beacon, and it will be held next Wednesday, the 25th of March at 6 p.m. at the St. Kilda Bowling Club on 66 Fitzroy Street. It's free entry, but it is first in best dressed, and you can find out more details by going to their Instagram or visiting the Save Public Housing Collective on Instagram as well. We are going to go to a song now.
Up next, we're going to listen to a song called Stitches by Mikey J, who's a queer folk artist based between Widjabal, Weeable and Wurundjeri land, who recently performed here in Naarm at the Queer Collage Party. This is Stitches.
I breathe into my lungs, something sacred has come undone. Could you hold my hand? Could we hold each other's skin like stitches? Keep everything in that threatens to fall apart, that pushes at our hearts. I lay my body down as close as I can to the ground. Could it swallow me? Can you feel my heartbeat persisting? Count my breathing, that breath too fast at the breaking of our hearts. Hold it down with me, some kind of song, some kind of melody. Hold it down, just breathe these broken hearts, just create new hearts. Oh.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jajarong, Kalkadoon, and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
Up next is an interview where I spoke to visual artists Fiona Barbetti and Stephanie Su, who are both exhibiting in the show Rage, Random Acts of Gentle Expression, at Trocadero Projects in Footscray. And Fiona is an arts educator and multidisciplinary artist working across installation, painting and photography. And Stephanie is a Hong Kong-born artist based in Nam who creates self-portraits in a variety of compositions. And their show is presented alongside fellow artists Aldona Kmiech and Florence Wong, as well as Catalina Labra Odi. And Fiona and Stephanie joined me on Sunday to discuss the themes of their exhibition and how their work explores the question of how they sustain creative practices.
Can you each introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Fiona, multidisciplinary artist that lives in the inner west, and I've been practicing art for more than 25 years now, from studying fine art at university and then continuing that practice in and among life of work, having a child, travel. That's a little bit about me.
My name is Stephanie Su. I am an artist and arts worker from Hong Kong and currently residing in Melbourne. My visual practice is mostly sort of painting, but also been branching out to a bit of installation and sculpture as well. My practice mostly explores themes of memory, nostalgia, grief, and identity. My work is very personal to me, so I like to represent a lot of sort of self-portraitures in different ways, in different sort of distorted compositions. And through that, I go through a process of discovery and healing.
I noticed that the name of your show was really, I think, like quite clever and sweet, which is Random Acts of Gentle Expression. Could you talk us through what the name of the show means and how your group of artists explores that question?
Yeah, sure. So it came about from us being involved in the Trocadero Project peer-to-peer program that supports emerging and mid-career artists. And so we were, you know, getting together monthly for about 6 months, and towards the end of that, we were looking at, you know, these ideas of sustaining creative practices. And so then this idea of this random acts of gentle expression, thinking about, you know, passion and frustration arising, you know, in an arts practice. And these concepts, I guess, of, you know, time and conflict and growth, you know, life intertwining with art making. And then also, I guess, these like negotiations that you're constantly making to sustain a creative practice. And so I guess each of our works is a response to these themes that we were exploring through that program in support that was supported by Trocadero.
Yeah, I think Fiona summed it up very well. I think the title especially really spoke to us because of its duality. So random acts of gentle expression, also in its short form, rage. So really capturing that passion and frustration and sort of something we're so drawn to can be quite hard and difficult as well. But yeah, sort of really highlighting how much we need to love the work that we're doing in order to, I guess, work in this sort of field.
Yeah, definitely. And I really appreciate the duality of that that's captured in the title of the exhibition and how you each explored that as well. And I know, yeah, for myself as an artist too, it's definitely something that I've contended with. Fiona, in your work, you're kind of exploring, you know, how your experience of motherhood plays into that creative practice. And yeah, and it has a real tenderness and playfulness as well, which I really appreciated. But yeah, could you talk a little bit about your work and yeah, what you were saying through that?
Yeah, thanks, Juliet. I think that my practice has sort of always been surrounding these ideas of domesticity, and that within my practice now, you know, being a mother, you know, and these ebbs and flows that go on with my practice, that it sort of has become this natural progression that now I am looking at these ideas of parenting within my art practice and then creating works that do sort of flow on from these ideas of my, yeah, life mirroring within my art practice. Yeah, and I think like the work that I've made for this is sort of about these like slow moments and gentle expressions that do evolve then with age in parenting. Yeah, and sort of creating these like postcard memory artworks with my ceramic installations that, yeah, I've created for this show. Yeah, I think like wanting to make accessible artworks and possibly, you know, like relatable to parents also. And, you know, that, I guess, concepts of care and self-care surrounding chaos of lives.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like that you really capture that well. And yeah, I think even just like the materiality of the work that you've made, it really communicates that sense of like care and that tenderness too. So yeah, I think it really shines through. And yeah, I think I really related, Stephanie, to your work. I kind of loved how you were exploring that idea of kind of juggling multiple jobs with a creative practice, which I have personal experience with as well, and I'm sure many other people do too. But yeah, could you talk us through how your work visualizes this juggle of responsibilities with creativity?
So I guess my work is a direct response to the question that we explored: how do we sustain a creative practice? So for years, I've worked sort of as an arts worker, but also in different industries like hospitality, just to sort of make a living. I really thought about how that lifestyle was a little bit isolating, I guess, sort of a lifestyle that you jump from place to place. Even though a lot of sort of people in the industry can relate to it, it's not, I guess, a conventional mainstream way of working. For years I've been sort of really busy occupying my time, working multiple jobs, having a day job, having an evening job. And I've sort of come to love organizing my time around work hours, and having a calendar was, a digital calendar was very helpful in that way. And I love sort of color coding my time and moving things around just to make ends meet and just to accommodate for it, you know, all the hours that I can get in a shift or every workplace. And so this non-linear career path was became the root of sort of my work. Yeah, and yeah, as I said, I think my piece was inspired by my calendar sort of looking like a Tetris puzzle, and then I've sort of blended self-portraiture into it. And then overlaid is the Cantonese phrase that's pronounced "pasan fu," and it means sort of being overworked and unafraid of hard work. But it's also a phrase that can't really directly be translated to English, so I found it really hard to translate it to an English title. which is why I've just kept it as the Cantonese phrase. It's really a combination of fatigue and pain and sort of going to great lengths in order to be able to do what you love. I guess that title to me is both a reflection of the difficulties of working in the arts, but also a token of appreciation to myself to be unafraid to make the sacrifices.
Yeah, and I think the work really shows that, yeah, those conflicting emotions as well. And yeah, and I think it's maybe something that people who aren't artists don't realize, like, maybe from a distance, it does look like being an artist is really fun and relaxing. But actually, yeah, you know, as your work really shows, Stephanie, there's a lot of organizing and planning that goes into being able to have that playful, creative time as well. Yeah.
I definitely, yeah, feel like what Steph said, that, yeah, the lengths of, you know, what artists do to keep creating, and, you know, there's just that passion that, you just can't help it. You want to keep creating, even though you are doing this juggle between, you know, trying to earn enough money to pay your rent still, and, you know, juggling different jobs or times of, you know, kids going to sport and trying to get some sleep and everything among that. And yeah, I just really love being part of these discussions about, you know, how artists are actually making it happen and, like, how are you doing it? What does your practice look like? But also, yeah, like, I guess removing that illusion of that it's like this romantic, you know, artist just sitting in a studio all day and every day.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what's really nice about the exhibition as well is that it shows a lot of different perspectives of the different artists who've participated and what that looks like in their lives too. So yeah, it's a really wonderful exhibition. And can you point our listeners where they can go to find out more about the show and see it themselves?
Yeah, so it's on at Trocadero Projects, which is 40 Leeds Street in Footscray. And it's on until the 4th of April. So it's, yeah, it's a month-long show. And there's also great work in the show. There's another, yeah, gallery space that an artist, Avril, has her show on at the moment too. Yeah, and having these group shows is so good to see that, like, diversity in artist practice.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you both so much for coming on, and, yeah, we'll definitely encourage our listeners to get out and see the show.
Thanks, Julia. Thank you.
You're listening to 3CR, and that was a conversation with artists Fiona Barbetti and Stephanie Sue, who are exhibiting in the show Random Acts of Gentle Expression alongside artists Aldona Kmetch, Florence Wong and Catalina Labra-Ode at Trocadero Projects in Footscray at 40 Leeds Street. The show runs until the 4th of April, and more information can be found at trocaderoprojects.org.au or at Trocadero Projects on Instagram. And up next, we're going to listen to a song, Not Angry Anymore, by Gamilaroi woman Thelma Plum.
You can try to make amends, tell the world that we're still friends, but was it worth it? Just the thought of someone else who has you now all to herself, it made me nervous. Did I earn it? Did I deserve it? Did I push you way too hard? The way I always pushed too far, always pushed too far. 'Cause I'm not perfect, I'm still alive. You know that I'm not angry anymore. No, no.
was the song Not Angry Anymore by Thelma Plum, a Gamilla Ray woman. And next up on the show, we are going to be interviewing Nazarin today. And we will be, sorry, Nazarin is an Iranian immigrant and feminist advocating for women's rights in Iran. With the current outbreak of war in Iran and the recent assassination of the tyrannical leader, there's definitely a lot of upheaval in Iran. And, of course, with the recent blackout of internet in Iran, it's been hard to hear about the Iranian experience. So thank you so much for joining us today, Naz.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's an amazing opportunity to be able to talk to your listeners in one of the, like, you know, forums that I feel people are listening to it with open minds and open hearts and definitely are curious. That's essentially what I'm seeing is lacking in the discourse a lot. And more recently, I think because of people's trauma, people's fear of the war, people's lack of information, the propaganda of Islamic Republic and the propaganda of other countries, definitely being very stronger than any of us individually. Unfortunately, I'm seeing that a lot of misunderstandings, misinformation, people closing up themselves to different sides of what is going on. And the internet shutdowns that you mentioned are definitely a really, really big problem in Iran right now. So today, basically, I want to tell you about a recent conversation that I had with someone in Hozier Lane. I was doing a graffiti in Hozier Lane for International Women's Day. There are still some works up, so if you have any time this week, go and check them out before they're gone. Yeah. And the piece that I did was a miniature picture of a woman. I copied it from old miniature paintings, Iranian miniature paintings, and I gave that figure a placard that said, "Iran needs your help." Mm-hmm. Someone who was passing by, an older woman, stopped and asked me, "How can we help Iran?" Mm-hmm. And I gave her, we had a really good conversation. Basically, the short of it was internet access, listening to the Iranians, and advocating for humanitarian aid to get to Iran, something like Red Cross to get involved. And yeah, here to tell you a little bit about each of them.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. Yes, because, yeah, it's important for everyone to know what's happening. And I feel like it's definitely not covered as much in the mainstream media as I think is, yeah, fair. So thank you so much for sharing with us today. What could you tell us about what life is like at the moment for Iranians, particularly Iranian women?
It is, to be honest, hard to get accurate information. The main reason of that is definitely the internet shutdown. So what happened was in January, there was a really big round of protests. It started because of economic pressures, but definitely went to the core problem, which is the tyranny of Islamic Republic regime that you mentioned, that basically their ideology rules over all of their decisions and all of their actions to the point that they're happy to sacrifice people's lives and well-being and their health and their dignity for protecting and promoting their ideology. At that time, 7th and 8th of January was the biggest protests. It was the biggest crowds I've ever seen. The footage that came out from those days at the early hours when the protests started was honestly something out of this world. I never expected that. The huge crowds going to the streets. The government shut down the internet on the 7th of January. And by that point, huge crowds were in streets all over Iran in so many different cities, and they started shooting at people. It was a horrible massacre. And our community definitely still hasn't recovered from that. And now another round of massacre, a war, and worse situations have happened. At that point, they shut down the internet for a very long time. After that, when people managed to get access to the internet, it was definitely way more restricted than what we had before. But even through that time, some people managed to get footage of this massacre out. The most famous one was a 12-minute video of someone walking around in the Kahrizak morgue, that the morgue was out of capacity in their cool rooms, so they just had piles and piles of body bags on the ground, and families had to go through body bag after body bag, opening it to see if this is their loved one or not. From that footage, we saw so many of the bodies of the people who died. They were naked. They still had medical devices on them, so like medical monitors on their chest, but they were shot in the head. That was evidence of what we were all really worried about, of attacks to the hospitals. Just yesterday, a story came out about a group of nurses in a hospital in Tehran that when they were helping these wounded protesters, the regime forces came in, they kidnapped some of them, killed some of the rest right there in the hospital. And they prevented the nurses and the medical staff of providing aid. Some of them refused and they got arrested. Two of the nurses of that group got shot right in front of their colleagues in the basement of the hospital. The rest were taken to prison, and that started a very long period of torture, imprisonment, and rape. Rape by the Islamic Republic forces, and also rape by objects, to the point that two of them, after they somehow managed to come out, again, these reports came out anonymously, so we don't know that much of their detail, but this part of it is verified, that both of them had to have their uterus removed and part of their colon removed, and because of the torture that they witnessed. At the same time, when all of this was happening, those footage that we saw initially, and the families who were managed to getting bodies of their family members back from the morgue and everything, it was majority men, and everyone was questioning, where's the bodies of women? Mm-hmm. And these videos came out of the head of the mortuary saying that we have to remove the reproductive organs before we can release the body to you. We all know that is a way to hide evidence of their crimes. 3 years ago, when Women Life Freedom Movement was happening, mm-hmm. after death of Mahsa Jina Amini in the custody of Iran's morality police, one of the very horrific cases was the case of Nikosha Karami. She was missing for 10 days, mm-hmm. and then after 10 days, finally her body was released to her family. After 2 years, finally, the coroner's report came out. They didn't give it to the family at the time. The coroner's report had extensive details of signs of sexual assault. And other pieces that the family and other women's rights activists managed to put together in Iran about the horrific night of her death described after she was arrested, after essentially she was kind of like kidnapped, because it wasn't even a proper arrest. She was raped by 10 men in an ice cream van. A van for, like, you know, moving food, which is like one of the tactics that Islamic Republic has used a lot. Making so much of resources that people are supposed to rely on symbols and weapons of their destruction under her. I didn't want to actually talk about this, but that's where the conversation went. Mm-hmm. But imagine when a regime so easily does these horrific acts on mass, on scale, horrific scales. How much more can they do when they shut down the internet to their own people? Mm-hmm. And just a couple days ago, a spokesperson of the government of Iran, she said that, well, we are going to give the internet to a selected few who can amplify our voices. Mm-hmm. They claim that they're shutting down the internet because Israel and America can find where people are based on internet connection, or when people take footage of the bombings, that gives more data to Israel and America. But at the same time, it really allows them to continue horrific acts in silence. And just yesterday, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Iran had an interview with Face the Nation. I understand that's an American program. And the interviewer asked her right away, "You're connecting to us via Zoom, but your people don't have internet. How come?" And he said, "Because I'm the voice of my people." How can a regime that has been killing and torturing and imprisoning us for decades now be the voice of any reasonable population of Iran? And at the same time, I am seeing a new wave of content creators. I'm getting a lot of them on TikTok and Twitter, interestingly, that they are essentially promoting kind of like pro-regime propaganda. Women that are not wearing hijab, but they're going to pro-regime protests in Iran, and they're posting about their experience. Women who are making songs about it and singing about it, even though women singing in Iran has been banned for years, and so many women who performed or sang have been imprisoned, still imprisoned to this day. So when I'm looking at this landscape, a very strong propaganda of this regime, they are controlling ways of communication, they are giving internet to their selected content creators, I am really worried that what an average person in Australia looking onto this content coming out would basically more likely fall for the propaganda of the regime and not understand a lot of the truth. Also, another issue of access to internet, when Israel and America are issuing evacuation warnings for different areas, well, people in Iran cannot see it.
Yeah, okay.
So they're in danger.
So it sounds like, firstly, thank you for sharing such, it's like beyond words how much of a tragedy the situation is. It sounds like the government really has this control over how everything is communicated with the outside world and maybe with the with the inside
internally
as well.
Already, we have reports, footage, screenshots, all of this. They are monitoring who is getting access in Iran via VPNs and Starlink. And before, when they had like enough resources, they would go arrest those people. They have a new system that manages to track where Starlink is in a neighborhood. And now they're like also sending text messages to people saying, "Oh, we're seeing that you're getting connected to the World Wide Web and this is punishable now. Please stop." Their machine of tyranny and suppression hasn't stopped. And their officers are still on the streets of Iran every night, creating like a carnival of fear, shouting and telling people, "If you say anything against the regime, we're going to come after you." We have footage of them shooting at people in their balconies when they are chanting anything against the government. When Khamenei was killed, now 17 days ago, almost. Of course, it was a very strange moment for a lot of us. In one hand, we were happy that this huge, the rock on the way of liberty and freedom is finally out of power. On the other hand, we were scared that, okay, this is happening through a war. I think a lot of us wanted to see him go to court and have to answer for all of his crimes, all the people that he's responsible for their demise in the Islamic Republic. We didn't get to see that. But a lot of people, you know, celebrated that in Iran. And I just wanted to remember Nahal Ahu Qalandari. She was killed when she went to the streets in Iran in celebration of this death. And her family was put under pressure to say that she was a martyr of the wartime. Thank you so much for your time. If anyone has more questions, there is an Instagram page, feminista.melbourne. You can contact me. And I had more to say for today, but we're out of time, as I understand. But the most important part is try to listen to the Iranians, try to listen to our lived experience, and try to get out of the propaganda of the Islamic Republic regime. Thank you so much.
Thank you. If you need support after hearing this, please call 13YARN 139276 or Lifeline 131114. We've been speaking with Naz, an Iranian immigrant and feminist, and you've been listening to 3CR 855 AM.
Now we will listen to an excerpt of February episode of Breadline, in which Danielle interviewed Dr. Rachel Amposky, an urban geographer and member of the Save Public Housing Collective. We listened to part one of this conversation last week, in which Rachel spoke about the history slum of relocation, and we'll play part two today. In this clip, Rachel shares her work to pursue heritage listing as a strategy to protect high-rise public housing towers at risk of demolition by the government. Rachel details how heritage applications work, the different types of listings, and how it applies in this case.
I'm with Dr. Ian Polsky, an urban geographer who has pursued a heritage listing of some of the 44 public housing estates, including most recently North Melbourne, and I'm here to listen to the account of this process. Rachel has also been a long-term contributing member of the Save Public Housing Collective. Rachel, tell us about the heritage submission process you've been through to try to get some of the 44 public housing towers heritage listed.
So I've been working with a number of different community groups to find avenues to get some of the estates that are obviously due for demolition heritage listed. So for context, for those that are not maybe super familiar with our heritage system. In Australia, we have effectively three tiers of heritage. We have local heritage, which is administered by the relevant local council, and that acknowledges places with distinct local significance. Then we've got the state heritage register, which is probably the main mechanism for heritage. And this is a register that lists buildings, places, as well as items that are considered of significance to the state of Victoria, which is a really arbitrary and complex concept sometimes to argue what Victorian identity or heritage means. And then there's, of course, the National Heritage Register, which lists things like technically Uluru's on it, Sydney Harbour Bridge, things that speak to a national identity. But that one is, there's really less than 200 places on the National Heritage Register. It's really reserved for, extra special places. So the main mechanism for real substantial preservation with teeth is, in fact, the State Heritage Register. And so that's what we've been working on, trying to get some of these states nominated to the Victorian Heritage Register. And so effectively how that would work, if something was deemed to be of significance and put onto the register, it's automatically granted a certain level of protection depending on what is identified as significant. So the assessment process would identify what's significant, essentially encode that into a planning overlay, and then would stipulate a set of protections that have to specifically address what is considered significant. So if the material is considered significant, the protections will focus on the material. If the name is considered significant, the protections will focus on the name, and so on.
Yeah. So what would material be an example of?
Oh, so literally often the facade, and this is how you see a lot of examples of what in the heritage world is called facadism, where the facade of an old building has been kept and everything past the immediate first 5 centimetres is gutted and reworked. So there really is a bias in our heritage protection towards the facades, and that's why you see a lot of buildings can get gutted internally. However, in the case of the public housing towers, that's actually not necessarily a problem, because we obviously want to see the towers retrofit and upgraded. And so there's this sort of common anxiety, and a very reasonable anxiety, that a heritage protection would lock the towers in place and in time and not allow for even basic, let alone substantial upgrades and retrofits. However, if the submission acknowledges that the significance of them is the towers as public housing towers, and that is what's significant as opposed to the brick and mortar, it creates a lot of leeway for retrofit. And I'll also note that even the most intense heritage listing in terms of preservation, like they stipulate an extremely wide list of criteria for what must be preserved. Even in those cases, there is always a provision that amenity and updates that ensure livability and sustainability and safety are automatically exempt from permits. So if you need to upgrade your cooling system, if you need to upgrade accessibility, you never need a real permit for that.
So the government's excuse says sometimes one of the excuses, I think, has been upgrading things in terms of disability access. So that would be exempt anyway.
Totally. Yes.
So what did the process look like to apply for this? And the other thing is, you said you're trying to get an exemption for the whole public housing as a kind of place. So what sort of criteria what does that mean?
Totally. So heritage is this frustrating thing where the heritage assessment process, how it works, and maybe that's a useful context for where we are in the campaign. It essentially takes three kind of key steps. The first one is a public nomination. So the state itself can never put a place up for protection. Only the public can. And there's this common misconception I find when I talk to people about it, that they assume the state can self-nominate, it can self-identify what it thinks is important and put it up for preservation. That doesn't actually work like that. Wow. It requires the public to put something up and to be proactive. And that's the only way that an assessment process is triggered and can only be triggered by the public. And so I think a lot of people just have this feeling that, someone else is triggering it. Someone else is taking care of it. And in the case of the towers, most people I talked to thought, I already thought it was heritage listed, or at least there'd been attempts made. And that's obviously not the case. So it starts with anyone from the general public. You don't have to live there. You don't have to have any material or social ties to the place. Putting in a request for a nomination assessment. And then the first body who does an assessment, who receives that submission and does the first round of assessment, is called Heritage Victoria. And they're a bureaucratic arm in the government. They sit, I believe, in the planning department. And so they, have their internal experts and they do an assessment. And at the end of that assessment process, which can take anywhere from 5 weeks to 2-3 years, the executive director of Heritage Victoria will make a formal recommendation, and they will either recommend to list the place or not list the place, or they can also recommend to list parts of the place and not other parts. So they might say, we did an assessment and we only found one part of this estate is significant, for example. And then what happens is it then gets handed over to the Heritage Council, which is an independent expert statutory body who makes the final decision. And so they receive the report and the recommendation for the executive director, as well as any public submissions that come in during that time.
So they're independent, but who funds them?
So they're government appointed and they are government funded. Right. So they're an independent statutory body. So they're still very much, in the government, but they're not in the bureaucratic tier of the government. Yeah. But they are appointed, and I think they're appointed on a 2-year rolling basis from memory.
So kind of like courts of law.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And so when it goes to the council, there's a period of public submissions, usually 60 days. Anyone can put in submissions, stakeholders can put in submissions. You can also request a hearing. The Heritage Council then runs a hearing where they hear submissions either for or against, and then they make the final ruling. And so that's usually the process. It's this frustrating thing where on the surface, this process seems, and it's designed to seem, really accessible, that anyone in the general public can put in a submission. Mm-hmm. And that is technically true. That's administratively true. Like anyone can create an account on the planning portal and put in a submission. It's free. You don't have to prove any kind of credentials to be able to do it, anything of the like. You just have to have an email address, really. But the challenge becomes that a lot of submissions that get put in get rejected because they don't speak to the heritage criteria. And so this is where it gets a bit tricky. So for something to get onto the Victorian Heritage Register, it has to meet at least one of 7 heritage criteria. And the criteria are, I would argue, really not intuitive to what you and I would consider to be of actual heritage significance. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of people talk to me about the building when I mention I'm working on this, and they have all these incredible stories. And the frustrating thing is those stories don't translate to this really specific and highly technical set of criteria and threshold criteria that you then have to argue that a place satisfies in order to get listed. And so while it's technically a completely accessible process and it's open to anyone in the public, to really actually be successful in your nomination, you have to know how to create really technical arguments that can address a very specific and very counterintuitive set of criteria. Yeah. And so it becomes quite difficult, unfortunately. It's not impossible, but it is not as accessible as it probably looks on, you know, on first glance. Yeah, so look, there's a set of criteria. One of the latest criteria that got added after a lot of push from the industry is criterion G, which is social value. It's when a place has social value. So for a long time, social value wasn't even captured in our heritage criteria. And this is why there has been such a privileging of like architecture and design and materiality when it comes to preserving a place, and not so much for like the lived stories. And so there was a big push to have that better reflected, and they extended the criteria for the first time in decades, and they added a seventh criteria, social value criteria G, which it was, you know, a huge moment and a milestone. However, it's really rarely tested. Like very rarely a place has actually accepted onto the heritage register because they've satisfied that criteria. So it's this funny one where they've added it, but they don't really engage with it because it's, you know, probably quite hard to prove, but also could really open a can of worms politically.
So is there any precedence of winning on this social value?
Not from my memory, no.
Okay. Yeah. So that's quite exciting, yeah. But it's like a test for us.
Totally.
So where are you at now? What's happened with, I understand you put in, I thought, an application for Flemington and North Melbourne, and then it's only been North Melbourne. Can you tell us what happened with those two estates?
So I've been working on a couple of nominations of different estates, and we started with just trying to identify the ones that had the best chance of meeting the threshold criteria, because the challenge with the towers is inherent in the heritage assessment process of any estate is a requirement to do comparative analysis. You have to always compare between, you know, similar examples. So classic ones, people want to list their Carlton North Terrace. It's probably already listed, but let's just use that as an example. Well, they have seven neighbours of that have identical terraces.
Yeah.
So how can you prove this terrace is significant, right? So there's this inherent component in a heritage assessment process that you have to prove why something that you're nominating is the exemplar in that class type. And so this becomes freaking hard with the towers when you've got 44 near identical looking towers that are built in a really similar system, built during a similar period, built under a similar epoch and policy strategy. And so it's like, how do you prove one estate is more significant than the other?
So what I'm hearing is that you need one precedence to prove that the next one meets a similar criteria, not necessarily that one is better than the other. Like, so if they've rejected one, like say they've rejected Flemington Estate,
yeah,
and there's 44 towers, then they have precedence that they should all be rejected.
Totally.
But we're trying to do the opposite.
Yeah. So
we've been listening to an interview between Danielle of Breadline and researcher Dr. Rachel Iampolsky about her work achieving heritage listing for high-rise public housing. Any community members with a vested interest in the towers and looking for assistance putting in an application, please contact Rachel via email, rachelimpolsky@gmail.com. And now for our events calendar for the week. On Saturday the 21st, there's the free Kaneki Solidarity NAM movie fundraiser from 5 to 9 p.m. in Docklands. An address is given on the purchase of a ticket. And this is to fundraise for a delegation of Kanak activists' upcoming visit to so-called Australia. You can go to freekanakisolidarity.nam on Instagram for details. Then on Sunday 22nd of March, we've got the Nationwide March in March for Forests at 11 a.m. Parliament Gardens. Walk alongside organisations such as the Victorian Forest Alliance and Bob Brown Foundation to call for real protection of native forests and an end to destructive practices. And also running until April 4th, you can go to Trocadero Projects and see the exhibition Rage, Random Acts of Gentle Expression at 40 Lead Street in Footscray. I think that's all our events for this week. Thank you everyone for tuning in to Tuesday Breakfast on the 17th of March, and we'll be back next week with more content. And up next is Accent of Women.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.